Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
You begin your career in radio in 1972. You work all over the Western United States, several times in the Los Angeles market. You win multiple broadcast awards, including the Edward R. Murrow Award for anchoring KNX's storm coverage in 2011. And now you're becoming a great writer and creator as well.
Thank you.
Clearly, it's the one and only guest for Author of the Week this week, author and creator of The Tattoo Murder. It's Bob Brill. How are you, Bob?
I'm excellent, and I'm really excellent because just yesterday we got the word that we picked up a really nice award from a film festival on a pilot we shot called The Adventures of Taekwondo Martial Arts Detective, and it's a comedy, and we picked up an honor for the award for Best Sound and Music. And I was really excited because it's been one really bad week, you know, and so that helped kick it off to be a good week. And so we started spreading the word on that, and it's just a really fun series. And the festival put out a 5-minute video for us that had video of like 8 or 9 different reviewers and their comments. And the coolest thing was, all the things that I was told when I wrote the piece, when I wrote the script, that, oh, that'll never work. I don't like that. It'll never work. Those were the things they loved, the audience loved. So, you know, it was a good confidence booster. It was really nice to hear. And the other good thing is from one of my producers said that, you know, I was like 8 people and all but one were probably under 30. Which, you know, in today's world is the dynamic that everybody wants to capture. And so that was really cool. So it's given us a nice little boost to try to go for the next step. And that means money and raising money and that kind of thing. So I'm really good. Alex, I'm really good.
That's important. And hopefully it'll get better through the purpose of this interview as well. Of course, you mentioned their Generation Z and obviously demographics and so on. I don't know. I think in the words of Samuel Goldwyn, the only thing he could ever conclude about the movie business is nobody knows nothing. Employing a
That's
double
true.
Negative. But what the heck?
It's so true, because it's like, you know, I used to have a program director years ago. I worked at a small station in outside of Los Angeles, and he said, "I don't know what works. I've been doing this in this business for 30 years. I don't know what works. I'd play all Chinese music if people would listen, you know." And that's so true. It's because, you know, it's whatever works at the time, and you know, coming out of the pandemic and going into the next phase or before, you know, it you just never know. I mean, look at Taylor Swift and Kelsey. And I mean, this is just a phenomenon that is just unbelievable that one singer could have this much economic power, not only just in her neighborhood, but in the world, and change things, you know? So it's like, you just never know. It's whatever works at the time, I guess.
As far as I can recall, I think it was USA Today who've actually offered a job paying something in the region of $100,000 a year for somebody who could actually follow Taylor Swift because of the, quote, insatiable appetite the Swifties actually have for Miss Taylor. I don't know. I mean, she's a reasonable soul. She's produced some good stuff.
Yeah.
I can't say she's necessarily top of my list. Sorry, Taylor, if you're listening, we're featuring Bob Brill. That's the bottom line. Anyway, let's motor on. Terms of your backdrop, because sport has played a huge part in your life. I mean, not only do you host the weekly fantasy football podcast, and we must actually confirm this is not British or European football or soccer, as you'd say over there. This presumably is what we refer to in Britain as, well, isn't that just rugby with pads? Sorry. But it's slightly more sophisticated than that, obviously. Yeah. But you're also, of course, connected very heavily, or have been, with the sport that, again, from a British perspective, we say, isn't that just rounders? It's baseball, of course. And you are indeed a baseball historian. I mean, clearly, again, from a cultural point of view, I suppose my major interest in baseball came from Field of Dreams. Great movie.
I love you. I definitely love you. It's my favorite movie of all time.
Yeah. And if they build it, they will come. And it was a wonderful way of really echoing that. I mean, clearly, the writers such as Rod Serling, who kind of played around with baseball, there was one noted Twilight Zone episode which featured a robot baseball player that was around back in the day, long before artificial intelligence and indeed ChatGPT were actually formulated. Rod Serling was doing that in the Twilight Zone. But if pushed, would you go baseball or would you go American football, or are you going to throw a curly and say neither? I prefer basketball.
Well, basketball will be third on my list. Actually, fourth. NHL hockey is third. You know, it's a toss-up today, but I think my love for baseball, even though the changes that have taken place in Major League Baseball in recent years kind of are discouraging, but as a purist, it's baseball. As a fan today, it's football. And then hockey, and actually I've got a growing love for soccer since Ted Lasso. So
well, thank you've got to get much. Ready because 2026 is around the corner and you've got the World Cup in the USA, in Canada and Mexico. Yeah. So clearly,
and I have to tell you one thing with I've had a fantasy football league for about 20 years, and we call it a keeper league, which means you don't redraft every year. You keep your players and you draft new players. And we have four teams in Scotland. And we have, there's a total of 14 teams in the league. And we can't seem to get that trophy back from the boys in Scotland. It is just stuck over there for four of the last 5 years. And it's sitting somewhere in Edinburgh. And we're trying to get it back, but we can't seem to beat those Scots. it's tough. Hey, listen, we know how ingrained it NFL football is becoming in the UK, which we love to see. And vice versa, we're seeing a lot more interest in your football, soccer. And to be honest with you, I didn't like soccer growing up as a kid because it meant too much running. I played fullback or goalie because it was like, I don't have to run that much, right? And it's all this nonstop and the pitch is bigger. You know, as I said, pitch, you know, the pitch is bigger and all of that. But literally since Ted Lasso, I have become more involved in soccer. And just as far as, you know, as a sport and loving it. And it's still, you know, down the list from football and baseball, but it's there. And Field of Dreams, my favorite film since the day I saw it, mainly because it reignited my love for baseball, but also brought me closer to my late father, you know, as far as realizing, you know, that was something that I was missing in my life.
Interesting. Of course, Welcome to Wrexham, which features Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney, having become the American owners of Wrexham Football Club, is doing a lot of good business as far as Disney Plus is concerned. And again, that's another interesting thing. I shall not refer to the Ryder Cup because you haven't mentioned golf. And obviously, that's had an unfortunate turnaround recently in terms of the American position.
I love playing. Let's put it that way. If I could play golf two, three times a week, I would. I live literally two and a half blocks from a really nice golf course. And I just don't get out enough, mainly because my fingers are usually on a keyboard somewhere. So,
well, let's move on, of course, sure, to one of the key things we wanted to speak to you about today, which is your latest novel, which, again, is entitled The Tattoo Murderer, basically featuring the story of a U.S. Army combat veteran who became a police officer back in his hometown after he'd seen enough injustice in the world. The tale of Detective John Potenza, an Italian-American who knows his way around the kitchen. I mean, I'm thinking here, is this the kind of quirky characteristic you've given him? He's a combat veteran and a police officer who also is a gourmet chef as well.
Yes. And even has his own cocktail, so that's cool. John, I'm Italian American, so I pull a lot of my own family history and weave that into the character of John Potenza. And John and Potenza is my father's ancestral, well, ancestral home. My father was born here, but his parents, my grandparents, were born in Potenza, Italy, which is about halfway up the boot and halfway between Bari and Naples, and is a really cool place. It's not the great tourist attraction that is a lot of Italy, but I have friends and relatives there, and it's a great place. So that's why I named John Potenza. And Potenza means power or force, and John Potenza is a power to be reckoned with. He has Sundays with mom and dad, family dinner, and his sister, and he is a brilliant detective who has. I like to describe him as far as he has a lot of ladies. He has his main squeeze, but he has a lot of other ladies, and she understands. And I guess my explanation would be that he's, when it comes to his ladies, he's sort of a local James Bond type, good looking guy, kind of suave, drives a cool car, loves music, especially John Fogerty and Creedence Clearwater. Just, you know, he's a rock and roller from that era, and he loves to surf. That's his thing. And the scene behind me is the coast of Ventura, the actual coast there. And if you move my body out of the way there, there's a street right behind me that is where the opening scene takes place, where a body is washed up on shore. And that's the beginning of the story. And it takes lots of twists and turns. And it's a fun story that we added a couple of twists that I've never seen done before and I always wanted to do. It's fictional, but we took a lot of pictures of places in Ventura where the fictional murders or the other scenes take place. So you identify, you can actually go to those places in Ventura today and check them out and say, hey, this is where this murder took place. Yeah, right there, you know, and you can be there. The other thing is I sort of wrote it in a little bit of a style of a movie script. I'm a screenwriter as well. And I wanted to give people a timeline that was short. And as a reader, I'm always looking to the end of the chapter, how many pages to the end of the chapter, if I'm getting tired or my eyes are getting tired. And every change of scene in the book, there's a break, and it tells you where, when, and the time of day and the date. So you can follow that along, and you can take the time. If your eyes are getting tired, instead of looking for 12 pages at the end of the chapter, you can see maybe one or two pages to the end of that scene, and you can pick it up right then, put your bookmarker there or whatever, and pick up right there and then. So I did that, and readers seem to like it. I'll do the sequel the same way when I get down to actually writing the sequel at some point.
It was all fun and games in Ventura until someone turned up dead.
Yep.
Good strap line. Like that. Very good. I have to ask the question, of course, given your fondness, or indeed the character's fondness, Potenza's fondness for classic American rock. Yes. Are we talking Ventura Highway at all by the Eagles? Are we talking about...
It was America. America did... don't mind me correcting you.
You're quite right.
America did Ventura Highway. You know, and that was soft rock from the 70s. I used to be a DJ too, so what can I tell you? And it's more of the hard driving stuff, but also the lyrics. Who'll Stop the Rain, which... is, if I remember, there's two Rain songs that Fogerty did. One is more about Vietnam, and while Potenza was in the Balkans War in Bosnia and Herzegovina in Serbia, there's sort of still sort of a connection there. And so it's more of the hard driving rock,
possibly Creedence Clearwater Revival and Bad Ventura Rising, perhaps.
Right, exactly. But I, based on your comment. In the sequel, I will weave in Ventura Highway, guaranteed.
Well, I'm also thinking, actually, given your Italian background, you really must take part in our quarterly Italian podcast special with one of our New York correspondents, Pamela Sue Mann. It's a thing called Memento Vivere, where we also connect with Italy and a variety of other sources there in terms of Gio Pilato. Talks about
his music. Invite, so, I'll be there.
There you go. But let's move on with respect to this. Sundown. Great Film Festival by Robert Redford, but nothing to do with this movie that I've just had a look at the trailer of in terms of the Western and the sort of excitement dynamic area from that point of view. Are you a secret Western fan? I mean, that wonderful mythological history of the American West that has been reframed and repackaged ever since Buffalo Bill Cody did his work back in the day with the Wild West.
Not so much a secret. I'm just sitting down right now to write my seventh Western novel. As a matter of fact, just yesterday I cleared a couple of things with a couple of folks whose names I want to use in the novel. I'll throw that out to you as far as Tattoo Murder. Would you like to be in the Tattoo Murder, the serial?
Wow. Well, this has almost got me speechless. So I will say rapidly, of course.
Okay,
you know,
good enough.
That would be marvelous.
We'll talk later when I get to the outline, and we'll chat back and forth and build in the character of you. So, wow. But anyway, so
an academic who's also a radio presenter, who basically has a Polish, Irish, English background, who's a keen Manchester City fan. Is that profile enough for you?
That's right. And we have to find a way to work you in as some sort of villain or something along that line. Matter of fact, I just got an idea. I'll chat with you later. It just popped into my head. A perfect idea. Do you like Las Vegas?
Yes, interesting.
In Las Vegas. We'll chat about that.
What goes on in Vegas stays in Vegas.
There you go.
The classic line.
Oh, now you're really getting in the eye. Now you got my mind really going. Okay. We'll get back to your other question about the Western. I've written, I always wanted to write a Western. My dad and I grew up in the late 50s, early 1960s, watching television Westerns when they were plentiful. I mean, they were plentiful.
You had Bonanza, you had Laredo, you had my own personal favorite, The Wild, Wild West, which many people say, that's not a Western. It's a spy show.
It's
a spy
show
and a Western. Yeah. It's James West.
Yeah. But even before that, we had in the late 50s, and actually the early mid 50s, Westerns were the genre that made it to TV quickly. You had Wanted Dead or Alive. You had Have Gun Will Travel, The Rifleman, and all these shows that were half hour dramas. Pardon?
Gunsmoke,
yes. And so you had all
Wagon Train.
I loved Wagon Train. Clint Eastwood in
Rowdy Yates.
Yeah. And so you had all these great shows. And my dad and I used to sit there and watch it religiously. My dad was a huge fan of the Westerns, and I fell in love with the genre. And when I started writing, as far as books were concerned, I had probably five or six books out there of different, because I don't write in just one genre. And I always wanted to write a Western, but I was nervous about it. I was really apprehensive, mainly because
there is only one Zane Grey, but I'm sure
exactly.
Zane would be saying, I'm sure Bob Brill can take the mantle.
Yes, right. So the thing about Westerns is the Western reader and fan is very, very conscious and very strong on the facts, because things did happen in the West. But the other thing about Western genre is what we know about legendary characters, they wrote pretty much themselves, whether it was true or false. You know, there's a lot of stories about Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday and those guys, and a lot of that was written by them, you know. And so I had to tackle that idea. And when I finally decided I was going to write a Western, I said, I'm going to write a Western series. It's going to be 10 books. I've written six. I'm just starting the seventh now. But the character's named Lancer. It's called Lancer, Hero of the West. And each book has a different subtitle. The first one is The Prescott Affair. The second one is The Los Angeles Affair. And El Paso Affair. Each one's an affair, which I stole from The Man from U.N.C.L.E., but that's okay. But he works out at Tombstone. He's a well-heeled, well-liked, good-looking man's man who is wealthy, and he works to solve crimes. He's a big defender of justice. He likes ladies, but at the same time, he's a respecter of kids. He's a good guy gunslinger, basically. And he travels to these different towns to solve a crime or to help out. The last one, which was the Broken Bow Affair takes place in the upper Midwest of the United States. And he goes to help solve a cattle rustling problem and finds much, much more than cattle rustling is involved there. So, and there's always a shootout. And every book, he meets a legendary character along the way. And in this one, he meets Jesse James. And I actually put Jesse James in a time frame that he was in that region toward the end of his life. But the thing about Western readers is they are so determined on the facts, you really have to do the research. And that was what I was nervous about. So I really, and today it's easier to do the research than it was 20, 30 years ago because of Google and stuff, and the stuff that's out there and now Bard and ChatGPT. But the thing about it is, when, for instance, when I wrote the New Orleans affair, much of it took place on a riverboat. And when I gave the riverboat a name, I had to make sure that the riverboat that had that name was in existence in 1883 when this takes place, because I looked up and there was a couple of riverboats that I was thinking about using, but they'd burned or whatever, or burned to the waterline in 1881. So I couldn't use them because I know what would happen. I would get cards and letters or social media blasts about, well, you can't use that because that burned 2 years earlier. You know,
but Bob, so all you'd have to respond is simply say, it took place in an alternate dimension. The multiverse solves everything.
I love Twilight Zone. So, you know, that works. But that's, so I'm on the seventh book now. It's been outlined. And the thing about people of today, friends and people are like, you know, I'll often ask, I'll say, you know, would you like to be in the book? You know, and I'll use their name. I get permission to use their name. We talk about a character, you know, and like in the next book, my really good friend from Scotland, Stuart Graham, will be the main antagonist. And one of the guys I work with, Art Sanders, is going to be a crooked sheriff. And I just got permission to use the name of a lady who is very, very heavy on my books. She's such a sweetheart. She organizes the cowboy festival for our Western books and Western authors every year. I love her dearly. She lives up in New Mexico, and she's going to be one of the not foils. She's going to be a sort of love interest to the main character. And that's always tricky because I said, okay, this is what the character is going to be. I got to get your permission to make it this. Please go over it with your husband, because I don't want any problems. And when I talked with one of the others, I asked him, I said, you know, if I make her your love interest, is that going to be cool with you? He goes, oh, I think it's great. And I said, you want to run it by your wife? He goes, yeah, maybe we ought to change that.
Always so, important. So I did. Scanning ahead.
He said it could have raised a problem.
Yeah, so prevent the things from occurring before they become issues. I have to say, full disclosure, in terms of favorite Westerns, I've already mentioned one of them for me is the Wild Wild West. And if you, I suppose, being true to form, you might have actually, as opposed to using the affair suffix, you might have actually had the night of, which, of course, was what Bruce Lansbury did with the majority of his things there. But I'd also throw in two series, which one you may have heard of. The other one, I'm not sure. The one you will have heard of certainly is Barbara Stanwyck in The Big Valley, which I always thought was excellent. And the other one, which I think was very underrated, but it's well worth accessing, just lasted for one season, created by Samuel Peoples, and it's called Custer. It featured Wayne Maunder.
I do remember that. Yes, Wayne Maunder. Yes.
Yep. And Slim Pickens.
Now, I remember that mainly because it was striking in color, you know, we were in that period where we were changing from black and white to color. Bonanza was one of the first color TV Westerns. And matter of fact, I taught a gave a lecture on Western clothing at the last Cowboy Festival, Santa Clarita Cowboy Festival, this last year. Which we finally got back to after COVID. We'd missed 3 years, and which is why I'm 3 years behind on books on Lancer. And it's interesting because if you look at, and this is what I'm talking about, true Western fans watch the clothing. Cowboys of that era did not wear belts. They wore a gun belt, but there was no belt around their waist. They either had suspenders or they had drawstrings. But if you watch Bonanza, every character is wearing a belt to hold up their pants as well as a gun belt, which didn't happen. Matter of fact, they didn't start wearing cowboys didn't really start wearing belts on their pants till about 1923. And I mean, not even in the previous century. So you get a lot of that when it comes to hardcore Western fans. Those are the things, you know, when you produce, if you're producing a film or something, you really got to be careful of, because you get that. I mean, there's the negative feedback from that stuff is horrendous, you know. So you really have to be careful. But that was one of the things I gave in this lecture, and I was showing all these slides of cowboys at the time. No belt, no belt, no belt. And then, of course, you had one of the things about Bonanza is that the sex appeal, and that was it. You know, you knew, producers knew, and the networks knew when, I'm getting a little off track here, but
it was very unfortunate, to be honest. I mean, there's Ben Cartwright, three different sons. I mean, being married to Ben Cartwright, you know, clearly was almost a death sentence, basically. I mean, you know, this is not good.
But the other thing was the four guys. Three of them were designed to target specific areas of women. In other words, everybody knew, the networks knew that the male audience was going to be there. It's a Western, it's big, it's going to, you know, good looking guys, it's going to be there. So how do you bring in the women? Well, you brought in the women with a good looking Canadian with a great voice. And that was, of course, Lorne Greene. You brought in the older audience of women. You appealed to that middle ground audience age of women with Adam Parnell Roberts, good looking guy, clean cut, clean shaven, not like me today, and you know, just like that. And of course, Little Joe appealed to the younger audience. Michael Landon, good looking stud, came out of, you know,
I always thought Dan Blocker as Huss was the younger appeal, basically.
Yeah, well, and that's the funny thing, Blocker appealed to everybody. He was almost the comic relief. I actually was the comic relief, but there was a section of people, and you know, he appealed to everybody because everybody of any age could identify, whether it was the humor, the fact that he was overweight, he was a teddy bear lovable, whatever that
it's
was.
All of Hop Sing's foods. That's what did that.
You love Chinese food, right? Some of the best Chinese food is in London, right?
Again, interesting sort of line. Let's move back to your own output, if we may, because obviously time is a little bit tight for it from this point of view. I mean, just the biography, you're living obviously in Los Angeles, survived earthquakes, a beating during the 1992 Los Angeles riots whilst covering the story. I mean, you know, when is somebody going to do the Bob Brill movie, you know, and who would you wish to play yourself from that point of view?
Oh, that's a tough one. That is, you know, it's, you know, I guess because I love film so much and I love storytelling, I'll be honest, it's in the back of my mind, has always been there. You know, I try to shove it out because, you know, you think, okay, they do that when life is over, you know, but at the same time, if somebody's going to do a story on you, on your life, you want to be able to see it, not looking down or not looking up in some cases. But, you know, I think, you know, to name someone like Brad Pitt or somebody like that would be so over the top and something I could never do. But I'd like to see the story done. I mean, you know, there's some interesting twists and turns in my life. I mean, I've seen a lot. I've, you know, there's still a lot to be seen. You know, I think in terms of probably I've seen more, and we've all seen more in the last 3 years than I know I've seen in the last however many 7 years I've been around. But, you know, it's because of the technology and how fast we're moving, you know, and it's so incredible. I mean, it's frightening. It really is. And when you turn to things like Bard or ChatGPT or just, you know, people, you know, your voice or your face or your, you know, if you're an actor, your body being used when, you know, long past its you know, expiration date, you know, it's quite scary. So to answer your question directly, yes, I'd love to see the Bob Brill movie. I would have to really think long and hard who I'd want to see play me. But
yeah, I mean,
somebody,
I'm
you know.
initially thinking in his prime, if you could actually pluck somebody from their prime, and maybe with artificial intelligence, you could do this, maybe Bruce Willis.
You know, I'll be honest with you. You know who I get compared to most? And you're going to laugh at this. And it's usually when I have my mustache or maybe a beard, and I don't most of the time. And maybe when I had hair, but it is later life, he didn't have hair. Sean Connery. I get Sean Connery a
Oh,
lot.
the Scottish
You know,
Connection.
always. Yeah. And I love Sean Connery. You know, I didn't like him as, I mean, as James Bond, it was Roger Moore for me. I, not that I didn't like Sean Connery, I did, but of all the guys that, you know, in the pecking order, it was always Roger Moore, because I like the humor. I like that dry humor. And the fact that in the if you, I can't think of the title of the one where they go to outer space, he's riding up
Moonraker.
the hill. Moonraker, yes. They're riding up the hill and he sees the Marlboro Man, and you hear that great music from one of my favorite films of all time, The Magnificent Seven. Dun 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 dun. It's like,
Yeah, so
I
he's
love
riding
it.
across the pampas. There are people, of
Yes.
course, who would say that was the moment Roger Moore jumped the shark, the whole
Yeah.
series, but never mind. Certainly, I can never imagine Daniel Craig's era actually accompanying that, and who knows where we're going after this,
No,
but
you
still.
know, and Daniel Craig, you know, the thing about Daniel Craig, he was in a movie which I love, and it was with Tom Hanks, and it was oh golly, slips my mind at the moment. A Road to Perdition. Road to Perdition. And that was the first time I ever saw Daniel Craig. Hated his character, just hated him, and then loved him in James Bond, you know, and he came out of nowhere for me. And but that was such a, with Jude Law, and that was such a really underrated film.
Based on a
I think
comic
it's,
book, of course.
I, oh, really? I do
Indeed.
not know that. I do not see it. Learn something every day.
Well, we try to actually sort of have a bit of cross education from that point of view. The social media, Bob, I mean, there are stacks of ways around. You've got X, you've got, formerly known
Yeah.
as Twitter, you've got, obviously, Threads slash Facebook. You've got TikTok. You've got Instagram, and so on. Are there moments where you think, "Look, I can't look. Just whatever. You know, enough already." Or do you have a particular fondness for any of the social areas?
Every day it's the former. Every day it's like, oh, give me another, give me a break. Yeah, and there's so many local ones too. I guess, you know, I don't really have a fondness for one over the other. I think I use probably Facebook more because only because it's easier. It seems to be the easier platform. And still, even though so many people have fled, especially younger audiences, and moved to TikTok or Instagram, which one of them's owned by Facebook anyway.
Another one's owned by China. It's all part and parcel of the
Right,
whole
yeah,
thing.
you know, yeah, and you know, it's like, which I don't like doing TikTok for said reasons. I do it occasionally, but you know, it's I think Facebook only because it's easier. I do use it
Well.
more, and but outside of that, yeah, it's like enough already. I can't keep up with it, and I don't see how anybody does. You know, and if I need some help, I'll go to some 12-year-old. You know, because it's, you know, or my stepdaughters who are a lot younger than me, but you know, they're or my daughter. Or my grandkids will whip it up like that, you know? And so it's just, you know, one of those things that you know, it's absolutely necessary, unfortunately, but you know, it's sort of, you know, a necessary evil in the world. I mean, it's not going to go away, so you have to embrace it. And you know, there'll be something new coming along, you know, and next week it's sort of the flavor of the day, and you hope to catch what you're doing to promote what you're doing to get the word out there, because it's so hard to get through the noise. It is so hard to get through the noise, as you know, whether it's a podcast or a video cast or a book or a film or short story. You know, it is. It's an uphill battle all, and you're constantly battling. And that's one of the downsides of anything in today's world. You know, we always used to say, before all this, well, I wish it was an easier way, you know. And I remember growing up when they were telling us, you know, computers are going to make you cut your 8-hour day to 4 hours, because you'll be able to get everything done in half the time. Well, what they didn't
they
tell
lied,
us,
Bob.
You're
they
still
lied.
Going to work 8 hours. You're going to do 16 hours worth of work, you know? And so but it's not going to go away. So you have to embrace it, unfortunately. And someday maybe we'll figure this out, and you know, the world survives that long, and we'll get it done.
Well, I can confirm, as I tend to do when we go down the route of artificial intelligence, that neither of the participants in this interview are indeed artificially created, at least not to our knowledge. I think we're okay at that sort of basis. We are real-life human beings.
Yeah, I mean, what could go wrong? Could go wrong.
A Westworld moment there, and a Westworld reference, which is much appreciated. two final questions that we need to put to you. They are standard. And the first one is, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the Midweek Drive Author of the Week feature? Bob Brill, has it been good for you?
Yes. Zoom has been outstanding. And I've been on a lot of shows and things. And I mean, I think it's probably the best development. I mean, throw all the other social media and everything else out. Zoom, and now there's, you know, different variations of Zoom that have come along, and some are better quality, some are a little more tricky, you can do more things. But I think the introduction of Zoom is probably the best tool that has been developed for people like us, and just people in general. You know, I mean, a lot of people say, I hate these Zoom meetings, I don't do that. It's like, I mean, after we're done here, I've got a union meeting from work. And it's, you know, it's the only way you can get a whole bunch of people together. I mean, even our fantasy football draft we do on Zoom, because we've got people all over the world. And it's the only way we can do it, you know.
A comprehensive response, Bob.
Yeah.
The final question. Yeah. Can we look forward to featuring you again? Will you come back?
Anytime. You just ask, I'll be there. You know, we can even talk baseball cards at that point.
If you want. There you go. The Tattoo Murder is out now. It's by Bob Brill. Go and get it. It's essential. Also, check out Sundown. It's a short Western scenario. Bob, do you have a website?
Yes. You can, for books, you can just go to bobbrillbooks.com. And we have a temporary website up right now that folks can go to for some discounts. And it's called bobbrillbooks-holiday.com. And that'll go away at the end of January. But bobbrillbooks.com. And also bobbrill.com. There's a couple others too. And if anybody ever forgets those things, just Google my name, and I come up usually 17 of the first 20. Just remember that I'm not Bob Brill, the IP attorney in Chicago. I'm not Bob Brill, the drummer for Berlin. I'm not Bob Brill.
You're Bob Brill, the awesome writer. Bob, we salute you. Yeah. Take care and speak again very soon.
I'm not the set designer, and I'm definitely not Bob Brill, the bodybuilder.
Chewing on a piece of grass, walking down the road. Tell me, how long you gonna stay here, Joe? Some people say, this town don't look good in snow. You don't care, I know. Ventura Highway in the sunshine, where the days are longer, the nights are stronger than moonshine. You're gonna go, I know. In the air. dragging, no despair. Alligator lizards in the air. In the air.
It's only a joke. It's a bit of banter. It's not to be taken seriously. All of these words have been used in the past to excuse basically vulgar and inappropriate behavior. And shockingly, it seems that workplace sexual harassment is indeed as big a problem as it ever has been. And to actually talk about some of these, quite frankly, very troubling findings, we're delighted to actually welcome to the program today employment law expert, barrister Dr. Anna Lutfi. How are you, Anna?
Hello, thank you. Thank you for inviting me on.
Well, it's great to connect with you, good self, but it's just such a frustrating and really depressing story that we're actually covering. I mean, the whole notion of workplace sexual harassment running rife, but victims are scared to report inappropriate behavior. 48% choosing to actually keep quiet, according to this research by the Barrister Group. Now, as I said in the introduction, I thought we'd kind of gone past the kind of boorish era where people realized that, you know, certain behaviors are frankly inappropriate in a workplace or actually in any other place, really.
Well, yes, I think that is a perception, but the research does suggest that quite a lot of people are uncomfortable with the situation that has arisen in their workplace. And, you know, you started off by talking about jokes and banter. And of course, jokes and banter are a natural feature of human life, and they won't always be entirely appropriate to all people at all times. We've got to be very clear about that. But when we look at the test for sexual harassment, we're talking about sexual conduct, whether it's physical or verbal or nonverbal. If it has the effect or purpose of creating an intimidating, degrading environment for somebody, humiliating, hostile, these are really strong words in legal terms. So it's actually, you know, it's actually a serious matter when we're using words like that in law. And then you use the word fear, that people are fearful of how they'd be treated if they say something. So clearly a boundary has been crossed. By anybody's standards, if somebody is going to work and feeling that their environment is degrading and that they can't say or do anything about it. And of course, this conduct, if it's sexual in nature, is clearly nothing to do with the ordinary role that that employee is paid or contracted to perform. So that's the definition of sexual harassment. Unwanted conduct, which encompasses verbal, nonverbal, physical behaviours, that has the effect or purpose of creating an environment for the person which is demoralizing. And if they can't say anything about it, if they feel that their best option is to leave the job or seek another role or simply put up and shut up, then yes, we're going to see workplaces becoming increasingly toxic environments and not conducive to good outcomes, which I don't think employers want either. So I think it's just about getting the information out there that this is an offence under the law. Under the Equality Act, it's unlawful to sexually harass people in the workplace, and so therefore an employment tribunal can be the result. I don't think employers want that either. Are there ways in which it can be tackled without necessarily going down the litigious route? Absolutely. There's a lot of ways in which you can prevent things escalating and deal with things at source through an open and transparent work environment. And that starts with employers being aware of the law and educating and informing employees about the law, creating clear policies and also systems by which somebody can raise concerns in a confidential environment and also perhaps discuss with an appropriate colleague what's gone on so that it can be properly investigated with all the facts and circumstances taken into account.
A few years ago, of course, the hashtag MeToo movement shone a huge spotlight on this issue within the film industry and within the entertainment profession and so on. And yet we still see that from your findings, over a third of people surveyed believe that management accept or ignore inappropriate behavior, whilst a little under a quarter think that their business has a misogynistic and sexist culture. You know, I'm almost jaw-dropping at this particular stage because I thought, how much needs to go into the mainstream media to address these issues to realize that actually this is just not appropriate for the second quarter of the 21st century?
Well, it's a feature of human nature, isn't it? That, you know, if something doesn't strike you as particularly problematic, then, you know, what's the problem, as it were? It's only when somebody else registers that that's a problem that it becomes objectively potentially a problem. So I think a lot of people, you know, don't think that they're misogynistic or they don't think that they are sexually inappropriate. And I don't think our culture is helpful in many ways because we send very confusing messages about sexuality, sex, and what's appropriate at work and what isn't. You know, we've had this in some ways an expansion of our private worlds through the internet. It's very difficult to draw the line between what's work and what's private. People will bring online things with them to work that perhaps are better reserved for the private sphere. And it can create an environment where, you know, somebody might be watching porn at work, or they might be commenting at work about stuff they've watched, or sharing videos and clips, or, you know, and they think they're just, you know, communicating something that's amusing or titillating. And that's a cultural factor. And of course, people don't think that they are bores and bullies. But of course, if somebody else is empowered to say, you know what, that doesn't work for me, and it's actually really distracting and also insulting, then it indicates to that person that perhaps they have to, you know, rethink their position. That's why I don't think necessarily going gung-ho into a litigation situation is always the best thing, especially where there might be misunderstandings or cultural conflicts of some kind. Employers can be empowered to also initiate mediation and transparent discussions so that things can be resolved and all parties have a voice. But of course, that doesn't rule out the fact that where somebody is putting pressure on somebody in a sexually inappropriate way, such that they can't do their job and they feel personally fearful about going to work, uncomfortable about being at work, uncomfortable about being around certain people, that really does engage the law. And the employee should know that, and the employer should know that, because they are protected. Those people that are targeted, they are protected at law. And if they don't feel that their workplace is set up to deal with this appropriately, then they can go to the Barrister Group. We've got website resources and materials at barristergroup.co.uk, where employment experts have a wealth of legal advice and expertise that they can share with frustrated employees. But that's also a resource for employers who want to adapt policies that are fit for purpose and are, you know, cognizant of the challenges that face the modern workplace, so that they can create transparent cultures where things don't have to be ultimately litigated, because that's the worst case scenario for everybody involved.
From my empirical observations over the years, it seems to have been very much an issue of a question of power and issues relating to dominance in terms of a number of these particular issues. But just a general question, I'm not sure whether the research actually did manage to drill down into this, but is this primarily a heterosexual problem, or is it a case of it doesn't really matter what your gender happens to be, you can still actually have challenges with respect to workplace unwanted sexual harassment and so on and so forth, no matter where you happen to identify yourself as?
That's a brilliant question. I mean, you know, one of the reasons why the Barrister Group commissioned this research in the first place is because of high profile cases that have drawn attention to this as a problem. And we know, those of us who are following, that these cases are sometimes heterosexual in nature and sometimes homosexual in nature. You know, it's the way it is. If we include different sexualities and sexual orientations in our society, and we're open to those and we have equalized them in law, then there are consequences as well for people who exercise and perform their sexual orientation inappropriately. So, of course, it goes without saying that if somebody is sexually harassing someone of the same sex at work, That might not have been an issue years ago for obvious historical reasons, but it might be an issue now, which is why we're seeing, a rise in those sorts of complaints. Women traditionally haven't necessarily occupied managerial positions. Now that they do, and that's fairly common, we might see a rise in abuses of power by female managers against male employees. That's something we have to take seriously. We can't rule it out. So whilst the research shows disproportionately women are targeted, or at the very least are more likely to speak out about what they perceive to be sexually inappropriate behaviour from a male colleague, I think we have to be also aware of the changes in our society and how they might raise new fresh problems, and not be blind to those for risk of being seen to be misogynist or homophobic if the perpetrator is a gay person or a woman, and that just adds to the complexity of the issue, which is why employers have to be very on it, because they don't want these things translating into endless employment tribunals. It's bad for their reputation. It's bad for their company culture. And it doesn't increase performativity or productivity. So we've got to have a self-interested employer approach where they say we want to create a more transparent culture where people can communicate with appropriate people when something arises and not punish people for raising concerns. And we also have to make sure that employees understand that they do have protections, whoever they are, whatever they are. And the point about seniority is really crucial, because 69% of participants in the research were saying that the behaviour was coming from a senior colleague. So yes, that's obviously going to play a role. If you feel that the person that is behaving towards you in an inappropriate way has, a say in whether or not you get promotion, or whether or not you progress in any capacity at work, or whether or not they have so much authority and respect that it is verboten at work to even question their decision making or their character, then you will go silent or you'll seek jobs elsewhere. Well, that can't be right. So, sexual harassment, the law is clear. The employer should be educating employees about the law and making sure they've got proper, sensible, common sense approaches to dealing with situations as they arise, to try and tackle patterns of behaviour that might not be healthy at work, to generate the best possible outcomes for all concerned.
Yeah, I think you mentioned a very key polysyllabic word within that whole range, Anna, and that's communication. We do need to actually learn to communicate sensibly, respectfully, and indeed acknowledge that we should really have as a maxim treating other people as we wish to be treated ourselves. But maybe that's just too simple.
It doesn't hurt, does it?
Dr. Anna Lutfi, expert, the law expert barrister, and indeed from the barrister group, many thanks indeed. And hopefully when next we speak, it'll be about more positive things.
Yes. Thank you for having me.